This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mary Gordon has said that in her new book, she wanted to explore what it's like to live in a female body. Her new book also has variations on themes she's written about in previous novels, the complications of romantic love, parental love, and spiritual devotion. Her new book, The Rest of Life, Three Novellas, was called remarkable in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. Before we talk with her, let's hear a reading from the first novella, Immaculate Man. The main character is a woman who has gone a long time without a passionate sexual involvement with a man, and she's afraid that when or if she loses this particular lover, she'll be alone again, and that it will be worse than it was before.
Do you know what it's like when you give up the idea that you'll ever again be prized? In a way, it's not so terrible. But all the songs, the stories, are about someone else, some other kind of person. You hear songs or stories, you see lovers, any age, any people just walking on arm in arm, on any kind of street. The wind can be blowing, it can be lifting sheets of newspaper, throwing whole clumps of pages into the river. You can be by a river or else on a dark street where there are looming buildings. The sun can be bright or not. It can be morning, evening. It can be a bit cold or else tropically humid. If it's cold, for example, you'll see a man take a woman's hand and chafe it. You'll see his lips saying, "You're so cold." On a languid day, she'll lean against him. "I'm so tired," she'll be saying, or, "It's so nice to lean against you like this." Or teenagers will be kissing in a shopping mall. An old woman will help her husband across the street because the light is beginning to turn. Anything can do it. Anything you see or read or hear on the radio, and you think, "That's not me. None of that is me. I won't have that anymore." You feel a bit self-pitying, a little angry, but it passes. It's not terrible. Many people live that way, a number of my friends. I expected to live that way the rest of my life. Living, knowing your body is of no concern to anyone except yourself. You worry that one day you might get sick, that you'll become a nuisance or a burden. But that's all. You know that's all your body will be to anybody else, a nuisance or a burden. No one will look at you attentively or lovingly. No gaze will ever rest on you for anything but the merest second. Then it will move on. You grow to expect that. You give up expecting anything else.
Mary, all three of the novellas in your new book are about women who love men and worry about losing them, or in one case have already lost him. What were you examining about relationships in the stories?
I think what I'm trying to examine is the place where women really are now. And I guess women of my generation, or my cohort, really, women I would say between 40 and 65, say. And we're not the women who were denied sexual experience. We're the women who have had sexual experience. And then what? So if the story isn't Anna Karenina, you know, if we haven't all ended up under the wheels of a train, where have we ended up? And it seems to me that the experience of passionate love is a frightening one for both men and women, but especially for women, I would say. Two of my characters, the first two, are in relationships with men presently. One of them is with a man who was a virgin when she met him. He was 43 and still a virgin. And she's afraid that he's only with her because he didn't know any better. And now that he knows better, he'll be with someone else. And my second character is with a man who is constantly putting himself in physical danger. He's a journalist who travels to the hot danger spots of the world. And she's afraid she's going to lose him in death. And I think the reality is that if you are attached to somebody passionately, the loss of them would be a terrible thing. I think that if you do somehow place your body next to the bodily life of a man, it's not that if the man goes away, you stop living, but you live differently. And it's that differently that I wanted to explore.
I know when I was young, I once woke up one Sunday morning to the sound of my upstairs neighbor dying. And his wife, you know, lived on, became like the widow in the building. And I thought, how does someone go on like this? You know, how does a woman who's been married all her life live without a husband? And it just, everyone's attitude seemed to be end of life, game over, that's it. And I no longer feel that that's exactly what life would be. Do you know what I mean? On the other hand, like you're saying, it would just be this terrible loss. It would be a different life. You know what I mean?
One of the things, however, that interests me a lot is how people make another whole life.
Uh-huh.
And it really is a whole life. It's not a fragmented life. It's not a truncated life. I've seen actually a lot of older women who get quite a kick out of their husband's death. It's like they're suddenly free and they're suddenly able to do things that they weren't able to do. I guess what I'm always trying to say is there's no one way of experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways of living with men. There are many different ways of living with men. There are many different ways of living without men. There are ways of kind of having part of your life with men and part of your life without men. And it's still a life. And that's enormously interesting to me. And what I'm trying to undo is that notion that women are either locked into life with a man, that equals alive, or somehow cast adrift in this miserable dark sea, and that is being without a man. And it seems to me that both being with a man and being without a man are much more equivocal and partial than people like us had been brought up to expect.
I want to get back to the first story, the story that you read from. In this story, the man is a virgin. He's a 43-year-old priest whose order has basically died out. And he becomes lovers with a woman just a few years older who works at a shelter for abused women. What interested you in the idea of writing about a 43-year-old male virgin?
Well, nobody believes me that I was really more interested in writing about a virgin than about a priest. Everybody thinks I'm being coy, but I'm really not. When I was writing the essay Good Boys and Dead Girls, I was really exploring the idea of male innocence as seen from a male point of view. And I thought a lot about what innocence might be, and it occurred to me that the paradigm in Western culture for innocence is the female virgin. I mean, we have heard about female virginity until we could all, you know, die of it. But obviously, there is such a thing as male sexual inexperience. Not every male baby came out of the womb, you know, Hugh Hefner. And so I thought, what would that be like, that sexual blankness, for a woman?
You know, there's so much that you can't convey about a book by just kind of summarizing the plot. I was thinking about it when reading the story because I was thinking on some level the idea of, you know, a male virgin who's a priest in his 40s who falls in love and really desires this woman and everything might sound to somebody casually listening like, oh, the Thornbirds.
It should only sell so well. yes, it is. It's exactly like the Thornbirds. Go out and buy it. It's quite similar. Go ahead.
Well, the woman character in the story gets really concerned that as her lover gets more experienced and more worldly, not only about sex, but about other things in the world, that, of course, he'll leave. You know, why would he want her now that he's becoming more and more worldly?
Well, one of the things that interests me a lot and that every woman I know has one version or another of, I simply don't know a woman who doesn't, is the notion, I'm not desirable enough. There is somebody else out there, anywhere who could be more desirable. And
as soon as he finds them, it's all over.
It's all over. You know, all the years I've had, everything that I've done, it'll all be wiped out because he'll see whoever it is, Michelle Pfeiffer or... Michelle Pfeiffer is the one I always fixate on. But somebody, it doesn't matter. That I think so many of us are convinced that in the blink of an eye, some strange force will take the man that we love away from us. And I really wanted to play with that because I don't exactly know if the priest will leave her or not. He might not. But she's really convinced that he will. And that becomes a part of the fabric of their love affair, even though he's constantly reassuring her that he loves her and is in fact quite desiring. Nothing silences that tormenting voice. And I think there, you know, there are billion-dollar industries that are solely devoted to making women feel undesirable. And I think it's a terrible, terrible problem for women.
You're writing about women in love who are mature, women who are mature women, and women who feel very physical toward the men they're in love with. They feel that they have physically found the right match as well as emotionally found the right match.
Yes.
And I wonder if you think it's any different writing about the physical love of a woman in her 40s than writing about the, you know, physical passion of someone in their 20s, you know, who is still, or teens, who are still kind of like young and discovering things for the first time.
I think it's enormously different. I think that somebody once said to me about herself in her 18s, you know, in her teens, at that point in my life, I wasn't interested in enjoying sex. I was interested in having it. And I think that when you're young, just having sex is such an exciting or a different thing, or such a proof that you're alive or mature, that it's almost, I think it becomes a more generic experience. You know, the quality of frantic desire that I think marks youth changes, and I think it becomes deeper and it even is experienced in the body more deeply. So that to say that one has less desire when one is older is wrong, but it's almost a different sort of physical experience. And there's also a backlog of disappointment and betrayal and self-protectiveness. But I think once that is broken through, the experience is enormously deep. And in many ways, I think more satisfying than you know, it was when one was younger.
The couple in this story often talk about things like, can you know if you're a good person if you've never been tested?
Yes.
And there's a wonderful story. Let me ask you to tell a kind of brief version of the drowning story in the book.
Yeah, my character is swimming with her daughter when the daughter is 10, and the two of them get caught in a riptide, and the mother finds herself going into a kind of trance, and the daughter is flailing, and the mother is annoyed with the daughter, and in fact doesn't help her, just disappears into her own trance, and somebody else saves the daughter. And the mother feels that at the point in her life when her daughter most needed her, she failed her, and this haunts her. And her lover, Clement, says, no, you didn't fail. You panicked. And what you thought was a trance was not a trance. It was panic. And she doesn't quite believe him. She feels that she was tested and found wanting. And it's something that disturbs her very deeply about herself.
Does this relate to a way that you felt you'd been tested by a mother and weren't sure that you passed the
it
test?
It actually happened to me.
Really?
I was in Martha's Vineyard with my daughter, and we did get caught in a riptide, and exactly what I report happened to me. And I keep going up to my daughter, this is 4 years later, and saying, I'm so sorry for the way I behaved in the riptide. And she said, you know, it was about 3 seconds, Mom. Don't worry about it. But I replay it and replay it, and I feel like this was a life and death situation, and I blew it. I really blew it.
So this really stays with you. You know, yeah. The character says, "I can no." You know, I always used to say I would gladly give my life for my child, and I don't think I can say that anymore.
No.
because I didn't.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't either. And it doesn't matter to me that people who are watching it said it was 3 minutes, and if she'd really been in danger, you would have done it. I know that I didn't. And I'll never quite get over it.
I really would like to know how you got saved if you were drowning in the riptide.
Okay, this is very important for your listeners. You can get out of a riptide very easily. You just have to swim parallel to the shore. A riptide is a channel that goes straight out, and if you just, I mean, the paradox of it is if you relax and turn and swim in a different direction, you're okay quite soon. Actually, my daughter was saved by someone coming to get her with, and that was interesting, somebody came out to get her with a boogie board and forgot about me. And I just went out, but then I figured out how to get out of it. I was a strong enough swimmer, and I figured my way out.
My guest is Mary Gordon. Her new book is called The Rest of Life, 3 Novellas. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Mary Gordon is my guest. I'm going to move on to the second story in your book. And in the second story, it's also about a couple. And it's also, you know, the woman is afraid that she will lose her lover. This time it's because he's a foreign correspondent and is always kind of exposing himself to revolution and, you know, coups and wars and so on. And she works with autistic children. Well, in the New York Times in an interview, you said that your interest in autism was that you're obsessed with how difficult it is to live an ordinary bourgeois life.
Yeah.
Which is like the details of ordinary life. What got you thinking about that? And what's the connection to autism?
Well, autistic children find things that we think are very easy, enormously difficult. Getting dressed, eating can be enormously problematic for them. Walking in and out of a room can really paralyze them. Turning a light off and on can paralyze them. So I was really interested in the fact that what is defined as easy or ordinary or customary is really much more shifting than I had thought. So that, for example, I think it's really hard to keep a lot of clean clothes in your drawers at all time. But a lot of people think, well, of course you just keep a lot of clean clothes in your drawer at all time. And of course you pay your bills. And of course you don't let your mail pile up. That's just the way it is. For me, to look at my desk and not feel that there's a stack of letters I haven't answered, and then to feel terror at that would be a miracle. And I think for an autistic child to one day be able to walk in and out of a door without terror is a miracle. So I think that what one thinks of as ordinary or the minimum requirement is really very shifting.
When you talk about your obsession with the difficulty of living an ordinary bourgeois life, do you find yourself thinking about that even more when you're sick?
Yes, absolutely.
The reason why I say that is because, like, the details of ordinary life can really be overwhelming and time consuming and everything. But you know, you find a way you deal with it. But when you're sick, gosh, I mean, it really saps your strength, and there's like no energy left for anything else, and you know, it just becomes kind of monumental.
And you lie in bed and you think, I may never buy food again. I may never answer the mail. I may never go to work. It is really possible that I will just lie here and become more and more filthy, starve, and die. And that when I'm sick, that always seems very likely that will happen. And then I get terrified. And then I think that makes you even sicker. But I think when you're, or if I'm extremely fatigued, I sometimes will lie in bed knowing I have to wake up and think, I simply won't do it. I won't get out of bed. I will not take a shower. I will not go to work. I will just lie here. And then everything will be destroyed, and there'll be a kind of peace in that, because it'll be over. And it seems to me it would be very... The other thing that I'm obsessed with when I see homeless people is, at one point they decided not to keep up. They cross some kind of line. And I'm always fascinated in what that line is. When have you gone too far to get back into the web? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that would be really easy to do. Like, supposing you just stop paying your electric bill because you don't have any money in your checking account and you're too tired to get stamps. And you just don't pay it. And then all the power goes off. And then all the food in the house rots. And then it just goes on from there. And it seems to me it could start from the inability to buy a stamp, which could at one point very clearly to me seem to be too difficult. And I can see just letting one little thing go after another and ending up on the street.
You know, the characters that you write about are really not extraordinary people, right?
Right.
They're kind of...
Exactly.
They're interesting, ordinary people. But you're, and I'm not saying this just to flatter you, but I think you're an extraordinary writer. And therefore, when you're writing about these kind of interesting, ordinary people, they are somehow able to think in extraordinary ways. You know what I mean? I think your characters are able to think more clearly and eloquently than their real-life counterparts could, because you're putting the words in their mouths.
Well, and I think there's a difference between thinking eloquently and speaking eloquently.
Uh-huh.
And that's what a writer does. That is the gift that we have. I'm not convinced that that many people aren't thinking extraordinary thoughts. They simply don't have the facility to write them or even speak them. It's something that growing up working class, as I did, you really understand. That occasionally people who were enormously inarticulate and spoke 70 years of cliches will say a few extraordinary sentences. And you realize that in that inner life, there might have been a lot of quite remarkable things that were never able to be said. Everybody dreams, for example. Nobody has boring dreams. If anybody told you their dreams, they're full of details, which are highly imaginative.
So you kind of feel that what you could do is translate those thoughts into words.
Yeah, I think that's the great lesson of Joyce's Ulysses. I mean, you know, Leopold Bloom was an ordinary schmuck in Dublin. He wasn't doing very well. And the entire riches of English literature and English language are put at his disposal through Joyce, and you get this extraordinary consciousness. And I think that is the task of a writer, to give articulation to what is buried and yet quite rich in, I believe, most people.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for reading from your new book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Gordon's new book is called The Rest of Life, Three Novellas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.